Good morning, Mr. Clarenti.
Good morning, Your Honors. And may it please the Court, my name is Daniel Clarenti. I represent the petitioners in this matter. I'd ask the Court if I may reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
Fine.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, for the last 15 years, no court in the District of Massachusetts has allowed the recording and broadcasting of its proceedings. And this is so because Rule 83.3 of the rules of the District of Massachusetts are clear. That rule bars all recording and broadcasting of judicial proceedings in the district. In this case, which is here before you on our petition for writ of mandamus, as well as an appeal of the collateral order, the district judge grafted onto Rule 83.3 a broad and nearly limitless discretionary authority to allow a broadcast of its proceedings. And the district court's ruling in this case was incorrect for a variety of reasons. But those reasons, first and foremost, begin with the plain language of the rule itself.
I'm sorry, but I read the rule as being a little broader than what you state.
Well,
is it except that it has by order of the court? I believe that's where we're at.
That's right, Your Honor. The rule begins in subsection A of Rule 83.3 begins with the provision except as specifically provided in these rules or by order of the court. And I don't want to ignore the word or, and I'll get back to that. As we understand the rule, and as the rule makes clear, that sets forth two exceptions, two broad categories of exceptions to the broadcast ban that then follows in subsection A. Except as specifically provided in these rules, if we understand the or, if the or is to have any meaning, means examples where a court order is not required. Therefore, the provision except as specifically provided in these rules refers to subsection B and subsection D of the rule, which relate to both the operations and functions of the court reporters as well as the use of dictation in the clerk's office. A court order is not required for that.
Counsel, wouldn't you agree that, given the way you would read it, that that reading would work without those words in A or by order of the court? I mean, just reading C, as you say it should be read, would make the rule work perfectly well without those words or by order of the court.
Well,
and hence you're left with the argument that those words become surplus under your reading.
Well, I think that argument, that would be true of the entire clause. In other words, the except as specifically provided in these rules as well. If you read B and D, they could stand alone in the sense that official court reporters are not prohibited by subsection A. I believe that the respondent's position, as well as the position taken by the district court here, creates far more surplusage. Because if the by order of the court language does not refer to C, subsection C is entirely meaningless. The court has virtually in this
so it's a so our,
discussion.
It's a badly drafted rule, and for either of your positions, there is some surplus, it would seem, and so there's an inescapable ambiguity in the rule. Would you agree?
I would not agree with that, Your Honor. Because again, turning to the language of the word or specifically refers to. And I notice that my clock hasn't started, but I'll try to follow it. The word or specifically excludes from the except as specifically provided in these rules the examples where an order of the court is permitted. But the court doesn't have to stop there. In order to understand this rule,
excuse me, counsel. Yes. I mean, before we leave Judge Lopez's question, isn't it also a valid observation that the initial language of the rule really provides for two subcategories, except as provided in these rules, refers to matters like B and C, which are self-executing. They apply in any case without any action or consideration by the judge. Things like the use of voice recordings by court reporters. They're universally applicable in district court proceedings. The subsection, the provision for the permissive provision for the use of recording devices and the like on ceremonial and occasions, investitures, naturalization ceremonies, those require case-specific orders by a judge in each case. So when you look at it that way, there is a reason for that preliminary language, because it creates the division between those two subcategories of exceptions that the rule clearly permits.
Yeah. Obviously, we agree with that. It's a better articulated answer than the answer that I just gave Judge Lopez. But that is our position, that we have a general outline of the two categories, and they are reflected in the following subsections. But the court doesn't have to stop there in terms of looking at the plain language, because Rule 83.3.1 is relevant here, too. In order to understand, which was enacted at the same time, in order to understand what Rule 83.3 means, one must also look at the pilot program rule, which was enacted 2 days after this specific rule was enacted. And in order to understand that, under the respondent's argument, the pilot program rules become entirely superfluous. In other words, the court, under the respondent's interpretation as well as the district judge's interpretation, has the liberty to allow recording and broadcasting whenever it sees fit. And yet, at the same time, the district court, following suggestions from the judicial conference, enacted a detailed pilot program rule that set forth standards and criteria by which district courts may authorize the broadcasting of civil proceedings in this district. If one were to interpret the by order of the court language as so broad as it was interpreted by the district court in this case, then the pilot program entire rule is superfluous, and we have a situation where the pilot program was enacted, and when it was terminated, we reverted back to a rule where courts could do whatever it want without any of the structures.
Counsel, let's say that there is merit to your reading of this rule, but also there is some merit to the contrary position. And if we take the view, say it's a close issue, but maybe your reading is the better one. For purposes of advisory mandamus, if we say it's sort of a close issue, then it would be hard to say that the district court's reading of the rule was palpably erroneous, if that's a relevant consideration for advisory mandamus. In other words, how wrong does a district court have to be for you to get the relief that you're seeking here?
Well, the court has previously addressed a district court's power to construe its own rules. And probably the leading case on that grounds is Diaz-Villafane, which was decided in 1989. And in that case, this court said that the court must both have a sound reason for breaching its own rule and that no party's substantial rights are unfairly jeopardized. And I believe here, in this instance, the court falls well short of a sound reason. So I don't think it's a question of how far it broke the rule. It's whether there's a sound reason.
But Diaz-Villafane is a different standard. That case was on direct appeal, where the question was whether or not prejudicial error had been committed by a district judge who admittedly did not follow a district court local rule. Here we have a situation where the district judge is telling us her interpretation of what the local rule says. And as I take my colleague's question, all right, if that interpretation, if we think that interpretation is incorrect, is that enough to grant advisory mandamus, or does our jurisprudence require a special increment of incorrectness in view of the extraordinary nature of the relief that a prerogative writ seeks and the deference that's due to district courts in the interpretation of local rules?
I would say not. I would say that the issue is it sufficiently important, as the advisory mandamus case law suggests, is it a systematically important issue as to which this court has not yet spoken, and is it relevant to parties, judges, and litigants in the district?
Well, we can grant you all that. That still doesn't, I think, answer my question, or as Judge Selye put it so well. I mean, is that, how wrong? It can be systematically important. I think that's, I don't think there's any question about that. But for purpose of this extraordinary remedy, again, how wrong does the decision, even if we have reservations about it, we think it may not be the best reading of the rule, but there's plausibility to it. It's defensible. I mean, if that's sort of how we see the issue, is, in effect, do you lose given the remedy that you're seeking?
I don't think we do, because I think the matter is so important to districts, to the judges and litigants, and the parties in this district, that the court has the power and the authority under advisory mandamus to direct it. But I do take issue, obviously, with the premise of it. I began this argument by saying that for 15 years, this rule has been understood in this manner as to ban broadcasting. And also, there is a clear intent. We look at the Cicilline case, which dates way back to, it was a District of Rhode Island case, but it was a case where the court was examining a not dissimilar rule, or the Rhode Island rule about banning broadcasting. And the court went through an analysis of what this rule means and how it means and how it was constructed, and noticed what the court in that instance, I believe it was Judge Selye, said was a strong family resemblance between the rule that was at issue in that case and the judicial conference policies. What we have here is not only a court construing a provision to grant it some discretion beyond what the letter of the rule is, but to a degree that it flouts judicial conference policy. It's in direct contravention with that policy. And to conflict with the policy to that degree is a dramatic alteration of the local rule. We're not talking about a slight alteration of the local rule. But
I can't understand why you seem to totally avoid what seems to be a central issue here, and that is not so much flouting of the judicial conference, but flouting of the circuit council's it seems to me that's the central issue here, and you haven't even mentioned it.
Fair enough, Your Honor.
Am I missing something?
No, I have not gotten to it. The Circuit Council, which there's no dispute has authority over the district court rules under Section 332, in 1996, in response to a memorandum from the Judicial Conference, was crystal clear that this circuit bans and will continue to ban recording and broadcasting in this district. At that time, clearly, the Judicial Conference, or the Judicial Council of this circuit, interpreted and understood this rule to be a ban on the recording and broadcasting in this district.
Wouldn't you agree? I mean, even we had trouble finding that rule. So, I mean, it seems clear that it was not, that public notice of it was not given, public comment was not invited. I mean, that does, it may be very relevant to sort of understanding the background of the rule that we're considering, but in terms of its legally binding nature, there's a real problem isn't there?
Your Honors would know more than I would. We have, in terms of its public availability, I will say that Judge Becker, when testifying on behalf of the Judicial Conference of the United States, in 1980 in front of Congress, referenced the fact that circuits had passed resolutions acknowledging that their rules already complied with judicial conference policy. So people, or at least Judge Becker, appears to have been aware of this, and so there was some notice of this resolution. But putting that aside,
We're talking about 1996. You just said 1980.
Oh, excuse me. I'm sorry, in 2000. I apologize. I was operating in terms of decades. In 2000, Judge Becker in his testimony referenced the fact that judicial counsel.
Well, but the fact of the matter is, Mr. Cloherty, that in the administrative law sense, all right, there's nothing in the record that indicates that the usual notice and opportunity for public comment rules were complied with. But my question to you is, was there any need to do so?
As we submitted in our supplemental brief, the court didn't, or the counsel didn't have to do so because they were not modifying or abrogating any rule of this district. They're under, or of the courts in the circuit. And may I continue, or I'll...
Well, you can, but you'll use up some of your reserved time.
Well, just to finish that point, the court need only, this counsel only has to publish and comment when it's abrogating or modifying a rule. It clearly understood the rule to be a ban, and therefore there was no need for publication.
Thank you.
Chairman,
good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. Thank you for permitting us to participate, and thank you, Professor Nesson, for permitting us. Let me deal with the 1996 resolution directly.
I wish you would, because I personally think it's the central issue here. But
first of all, parties in their briefs agreed that it wasn't, that it was legally irrelevant for different reasons. One, in their case, because they think it's consistent with the rule. We disagree with that, and I want to explain that.
Whether anyone thinks it's relevant, the first question is, does the resolution have binding force?
No, it doesn't.
Why not?
Because, as the Judicial Conference said in inviting the resolution, something that is omitted from their brief, the order that they asked for was to be promulgated pursuant to Section 332D1 of the Judiciary Code. Mm-hmm. That requires any order, not a modification or an abrogation only, but any order relating to practice and procedure to be provided with notice and comment.
But there's nothing in the text or the circumstances of the First Circuit's deliberations that indicates that the First Circuit purported to act under that section. Now, I understand that the Judicial Conference urged the circuit councils to act and suggested acting under that section. But the question I have for you is why doesn't the circuit council have power to act as the First Circuit Council apparently did in 1996, apart from that one statutory section under its general powers, particularly in an instance where it apparently believed that the District of Massachusetts local rule, as it then stood and as it now stands, was fully in compliance with the Judicial Council policy, Judicial Conference policy.
Let me respond to the factual premise of the question, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm.
The resolution doesn't say that it is acting in any way other than in response to the Judicial Conference's March a promulgation. So
it wasn't a promulgation, it was an urging. That's the word that the Judicial Conference urged action.
It says, in response to the urging of the Judicial Conference of the United States at its March 1996 meeting, mm-hmm. if what you are saying is that a rule relating to practice and procedure that the Judicial Conference suggested should be or could be promulgated pursuant to Section 332D1 can simply be asserted privately by the Judicial Council, you're doing a number of things.
No, I'm not saying that. You're misconstruing what I'm saying or misunderstanding
it.
All right? What I'm saying is that if the Judicial Council believed that the District of Massachusetts rule was fully in compliance with the Judicial Conference policy, which appears to be the situation, then there was no basis for the council, no reason for the council to promulgate a rule of practice. It merely issued a statement, which, as I read it, confirms that it sees no conflict among any of the district local rules within the circuit with the Judicial Conference policy and endorses that policy as the policy of the circuit.
Now I understand your question. Okay. I think it has to do with the factual relevance legal relevance of the promulgation of the resolution. Yep. Here's the factual relevance of the resolution. It is inconsistent with even their reading of the rule of 83.3. Why? Because it says that it effectively describes the rules as banning all photographs, radio, and television coverage of proceedings in United States district courts within this circuit, except as otherwise provided for ceremonial occasions. That reads out of Rule 83.3, or ignores, subsection C1, which covers the perpetuation of the record and preservation of evidence. It reads out of the rule, or ignores, subsection 83.3D, which deals with the question of going downstairs and going to the clerk's office with a recorder. And it reads out of the rule the right of court reporters without order of the court to take proceedings so that they may have a record. So all of that, Your Honor, with due respect to this resolution, I understand that this resolution was intended by whomever wrote it, the Judicial Council, and whoever was on the Judicial Council at that time, to believe it was in compliance with judicial conference policy. But in the absence of a clear statement that is describing or interpreting the rule, which, by the way, was enacted 6 years before this was promulgated, this resolution is not sufficient extrinsic evidence, if that's what we're calling it, in order to reflect, in order to change the interpretation of the rule. Here's why. We've been talking all morning about a close call, or maybe you don't see it as a close call, but if you take Judge Lopez's hypothetical, close call between readings. Maybe theirs is better, maybe ours is better. Here's why it's unambiguous that she has some discretion, not limitless discretion. There's an adjective in front of the word discretion in every time they use the word. Not limitless discretion, but some discretion. This is a case involving 3,000, as I understand it, 3,000 or 4,000 defendants. Okay? In this courthouse, they will not, if they want to watch Mr. Tannenbaum's trial, be able to sit in Judge Gertner's courtroom. So you, not you, but the judges of the District of Massachusetts, may be faced with an overflow room issue, or two overflow room issues. You will need an order, or they will need an order, to have an overflow room. An overflow room to a group of people who are watching a public proceeding is a broadcast. If that is true, if you can get an order from the District of Massachusetts that an overflow room that shows on television, video, or a recording the proceedings taking place on the third floor in Judge Gertner's room, you have unambiguously created an exception or a category, a space, above what Mr. Clardy describes to be the limits of order of the court, subsection C, and infinity. And what I'm here to tell you is the judges exist. The process exists. The process we discuss.
I want to be sure I understand your argument correctly. All right? Conceptually, you see no difference between an overflow room, the room next door, which we typically use as an overflow room for this courtroom, and a broadcast around the world. You see no difference.
The
difference is one of degree, not of kind.
I see a difference. I see no difference with respect to the meaning of the rule.
Well, because it can certainly be argued that when courts use overflow rooms, that what that is simply within the courthouse walls. It's an extension of the courtroom itself. All right? It's as if we tore down the wall temporarily for purposes of the case.
Right.
All right? So it seems to me now, if you're talking precedents where there have been overflow broadcasts using the Heinz Auditorium or what those of us of my generation still mistakenly call the Boston Garden, that's a different story. Well, all right, but I don't think that's the analogy that you were drawing.
Actually, I do think it is.
Yeah.
I think there is a continuum, and I don't think we really can dispute that there's a continuum between tearing down the walls of this courtroom and the next courtroom and building a courthouse next door where Mr. Tannenbaum's other colleagues watch it, or a Harvard Law School auditorium. It's a public proceeding, and whatever is most convenient for the court and doesn't disturb, as Judge Weinstein said in the Brooklyn case, the process of the administration of justice is something that is not encompassed by subsection C. You are here on a narrow issue, despite all of the big questions.
That may be the first thing you've said this morning that I agree with.
I appreciate that. At least somebody in this room agrees with me in some respect.
No, I do. I mean, one of the misimpressions that's clear in a lot of the briefs, not in yours. I understand this isn't a major First Amendment case about free speech. That we do have a narrow issue, but it's an important issue, and we all want to get it right.
I do want you to get it right. Sure. But I don't want you to read this rule incorrectly. I want you to let the process work. If you agree with me, hypothetically, I know you're not ruling now. Right. If you agree with me that there is space above what Mr. Clardy describes in Rule C for an order of the court for something outside of what's listed in that rule, then you must agree with me that order of the court means something more than what's in subsection C. That's just logic. Now, hear me out.
What seems to me is that the district judges should pay attention to it.
It seems to me, Your Honor, one district judge has. Mr. Claudy says it's never occurred in 15 years. That's because there's never been an application. Judge Gertner got an application from Courtroom View a year ago in the countrywide case before it was transferred. And you all know, because it's in the record and it's in Mr. Claudy's brief, that she said, I wonder if this is something I should talk to the other judges in this courthouse about. She pondered that as a possible basis for denying our motion and asked for additional briefing, which we never got to because the case was unveiled to Kentucky. She may have, she may not have, but she decided that she didn't need to. She's the only district court judge who has interpreted this rule. Now, if you'll permit me, you are exactly right, Judge Turiana. You can have the district court, the District of Massachusetts can get together and agree that she's crazy. They can say this is not what we intended. And they will make that clear by amending the rule, which is what Rule 83 says it should do. And by the way, if the Judicial Council of the First Circuit disagrees with that, you know what? They can do exactly the same thing. They can do in a proper way, in a nation of laws, with these very reticulated provisions of the Judiciary Code, they can do exactly what they're entitled to do, which is modify or abrogate the rule, or issue an order in conflict with it, as we say in the last footnote of our supplemental.
Counsel, some of these larger policy concerns that you are invoking, both in your brief and here, those are all very important. But ultimately, I think our task is to try to understand what this rule means and relate it to what Judge Gertner did and what she says it means. And I continue to have problems with your reading of the text. And basically, it seems to me, your reading suggests that we have a rule that starts out by saying that broadcasting recordings shall be prohibited, except to the extent that courts allow it. I mean, it basically, to invoke a cliche, your reading seems to simply swallow the rule.
I'm sorry to interrupt you because I don't want to run into Professor Nesson's time, but I do want to answer your question. It doesn't swallow the rule. All it does in one instance, in a circumstance where she herself identified it as being an oral argument and said nothing about whether or not it would cover trials, it permits a judge to make an individual decision. It does not swallow the rule any more than in New York, the rule that absolutely bans everything, including BlackBerries. No attorney can bring a BlackBerry into New York. It absolutely bans everything except upon written permission, which is done through an order of a judge of that court. The world has not collapsed. 10 years have gone by, and about 12 proceedings have been televised.
No, that may be true. The world hasn't collapsed. But the point is that your reading of the rule gives discretion to the district judge, which is not limited by any word, phrase, syllable, or sentence in the rule itself. And the notion of that kind of relatively unbounded discretion, right, is puzzling in an area in which courts have been so careful, federal courts particularly, to avoid the specter of what was thought of as the intrusion of cameras in the court.
And I would just say, I mean, if we're comparing who's reading results in more surplus verbiage, it seems to me you win on that score because under your reading, this provision C becomes entirely unnecessary. So your reading creates a great deal more surplus than their reading, I would suggest.
I think our reading creates less surplus. Our reading creates more meaning to order of the court, unless you deny the fact that an order of the court is necessary for the broadcast that takes place even within the courthouse.
Well, arguably, under C anticipates that there will have to be an order of a court to effectuate what C contemplates.
I don't. In fact, if you look at, let me just give you A9, A11, A14, A16, A19, A21, and A28. Those are rules from whatever it is, 7 district jurisdictions. You know what they all say? They all say cameras are banned in this district, except as set forth below. And then they list the equivalent of what Rule 83.3 subsection C. Period, end of story. You know what they use? The court may permit. The judge may permit. There is not an order of the court anywhere in any of those rules. So it is a badly drafted rule. We think it's a deliberately drafted rule. Your job, with all respect, Judge Lopez, is to find out whether or not, in light of all those statutes I gave you, and in light of the way that you interpret statutes, and as Judge Sully pointed out, in light of the deference that he himself, in the Jarvis case, noted is given to district court judges who interpret their own rules, in this case you have to reject this position because I have given you a meaning to order of the court that you know exists. With all due respect, it is not limited to subsection C. Thank you, and I appreciate the time.
Thank you, counsel. Morning, Mr. Dessen.
Good morning. Good morning. May it please the court. I approach this from a different point of view. I represent Joel Tenenbaum. From Joel's point of view, he regards his property as being taken from him by due process. That's the way his address to the lawsuit that he faces registers with him. And he suggests that in this modern environment, the default rule has changed. The default is now open, not closed. And he has a right to a trial judge who wields the full discretion of an Article III judge in handling the matter that is before her. So from Joel's point of view...
Excuse me, Mr. Nesson. When you say the default rule has now changed in this modern environment from closed to open, do you base that on your perception of the development of society or on some precedent, some case where the Supreme Court has told us that the default rule has closed or something of that sort?
Your Honor, I'd go back to 1789.
But that's got very little to do with today's modern environment. You said that there's a change from closed to open. And what I'm asking you particularly is what's the basis for that change? Is it a change that's based in precedent or based on a new understanding of societal values?
It's based on a change in the environment, Your Honor.
Okay.
The advent of the Internet creates an environment in which it is now possible for the openness of the federal courts, symbolized by the open architecture of this building and the wonderful statements that are etched in the marble as you walk into it. The courtroom is now open in a way that doesn't require funneling through intermediaries that distort your process.
Wasn't that exactly true in the 1940s when television became a reality?
No, it was not, Your Honor.
It wasn't?
It took a while to learn, but when you have an intermediary, a profit-seeking intermediary, who takes and uses the public domain data that you are generating.
Well, in other words, it would have been all right in 1950 if PBS had applied for telecasting. That should have been allowed, but not NBC?
I would say this, Your Honor. It should have been within the discretion of a wise judge to allow the public to participate in the civil process of the courts in a specific proceeding where there is no reason to exclude. And here, with the advent of the Internet as Judge Gertner specified, gavel-to-gavel coverage, open on the net, in a case which is about the net. This is the internet in the courtroom. The substance of this case is the interface between the internet generation, the digital natives, and the copyright giant.
Mr. Nassen, is it your position that your client's constitutional right in some way is impaired if the court does not permit the proceedings to be disseminated in the broad way that you propose in this case? In other words, if all we have is a courtroom that is completely open to the public, that is not enough to protect the constitutional right that you seem to be asserting on behalf of your client, which I gather is a right to a public trial, public proceeding. That's the basic right that you're asserting, is that correct?
I divide it into two rights, Your Honor. First, I believe that Joel Tenenbaum is entitled to trial before a judge who is fully empowered. It's the discretion of the trial judge to manage the space of her authority. This is an instrument in the judge's hands. This is Solomon's sword. And second, I would then appeal to the discretion of the trial judge to say, if there's no reason to close the proceeding in the age of the internet, then it should be open, gavel to gavel, to whomever in the village would like to come and see. It's like we're back in the days when the jury was first constituted and everyone in town could come and see. Now it's a big village once again.
Fully empowered and empowered without any limits are two different things. Judges have limits to their power. And I think you're faced with one of the limits to the judge's power. And I think it has been, a question is whether it has been properly exercised or not, but judges have limits to their power.
I certainly agree, Your Honor, but look at it from the other way around. If I were to cite authority to you, I would cite the Daubert case, which seems to, on its face, have nothing to do with this. But there was a case in which the judiciary faced a big problem. As the judiciary now faces a big problem moving court trials into the age of internet, with everybody having Twitter accounts and so forth, it's a big problem. How will the judiciary do it? No better way than to allow the most skilled of your trial judges to exercise limited, careful discretion. Judge Gertner's order is not, oh, I have discretion, I can do anything. Her order was step by step. Let's admit internet to one proceeding only. That's all that order covers.
But this and argument, Mr. Nassen,
depends whether she has like the power to do that or not at this time, doesn't it?
Excuse me.
The issue comes down to whether she has the power at this time to do that.
And I'm suggesting to you two things. As an interpretive matter, there is wisdom in interpreting judicial rules so as not to cripple the discretion of your trial judges when needed in facing technological change. Second, I'm suggesting that you interpret the rule to avoid the constitutional confrontation with Joel Tenenbaum's rights, a right to a public trial in the internet age when there is no reason to close it.
Mr. Nelson, it seems to me you're making a very powerful and eloquent argument as to why perhaps this rule should be changed, but I'm not sure that you're making an argument that is entirely persuasive as to how this rule should presently be read. And I think that's the task that we have. We have to try to apply this rule as it presently stands to the current circumstance. And I sense you are unhappy with the circumscribed nature of this rule as it is written, and would like to have a different rule, and perhaps there should be a different rule. But I'm not sure that's our task today to visualize what a better rule might be.
I'd respond two ways, Your Honor. First, I do think that you're under a compulsion when you are choosing amongst interpretations to choose an interpretation which furthers constitutional rights rather than confronting them and overriding them. But second, I would say, look at this rule. It bars photographs, radio, and television. It doesn't bar Internet. There was no Internet was not in the minds of the people who wrote this rule.
So Internet, you're suggesting that we should acknowledge that it bars the more conventional media, but it doesn't affect the Internet?
Exactly, Your Honor. And when you ask yourself the question, as Judge Selye was asking in a different form, can you distinguish Internet in a meaningful way from broadcast television and radio? The answer is yes, you can. It's a medium that goes direct to the people, and so there's no intermediary. It's gavel-to-gavel coverage, open on the net. It is, in effect, a claim of the people to the public domain data being generated in a civic proceeding in a federal court for which the taxpayer is paying the bill. From a defendant's point of view, it's the opportunity to have the world actually see what the recording industry is doing to him. This is a kid who is being charged with clicking on his computer screen 7 times. And he has been in court now, basically, since 2003, and we're going to have a federal trial on the question of his clicking on the computer screen 7 times. It's bizarre, with him subject to $1 million of threatened damage. The public should see this. It's an educational proceeding. This very statute they're proceeding on purports to be educational in its objective. We would like to see this case tried in an open courtroom on the open net.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honor, this really isn't the forum. Obviously, we dispute the factual claim. We think there's hundreds of infringements, but I don't think that's the issue presented here. What's here, I do want to clarify, the rule says by radio, television, or other means, and obviously that involves any type of broadcast, and the Internet broadcast would be covered. I do want to come back to a question that Judge Lopez asked me. I may not have responded as well as I should have regarding the close question, and I draw the Court's attention to the Atlantic Pipe case, which was I believe a close question. In fact, the court grappled with the question of whether a court had the inherent power. And that's what mandamus is about. Did the court exceed its authority to order non-binding mediation? In that decision, it was a close question. And actually, the court determined the court did have inherent power, but vacated, still exercised its power under mandamus because of the manner in which the order issued. Here, even if it's a close question, the matter is of systematic importance to judges, litigants, and parties in this district. And so I would suggest, Your Honor, this fits squarely within the realm of advisory mandamus. But I also want to say this isn't a close question. We think the rule is clear. Even if the court were to conclude that there's some ambiguity here, we have a historical record that shows time and again the District of Massachusetts, as well as the Judicial Council of the First Circuit, adhering to judicial conference policy. Judicial conference policy, fair enough, does not necessarily control, but a clear, unmistakable effort to adhere to those policies. And I'll give you the examples. The language of the rule itself, drawn directly from the judicial conference policy as well as its predecessor, which is the judicial canon, which was also enacted by judicial conference. The enactment of the pilot program, a direct response to the policy statement in September 1990. In 1994, when the program lapsed, again, not reenacting it, not doing anything.
Counsel, wouldn't you agree as a matter of text, the point that's been made by respondents, the Massachusetts rule does seem narrower than the judicial conference rule in the specific respects that they cite.
Well, counsel did say it was deliberately drafted to be broad. I very much dispute that point. But on the narrowness, I disagree. There was a contention that somehow a broadcast within the walls of the court is a broadcast. And we cited case law in our brief district court case from Eastern District of New York saying that a video recording kept in and under control.
But it omits references, I guess, to judicial administration security, matters like that.
Well,
and so that at least, if your premise is that Massachusetts was trying to faithfully follow the conference rule policy that was adopted, there's textual evidence that that isn't the case.
Well, there's far more textual evidence that there is the case. If they left out something like security cameras, I think we would be here on the standard would be quite different if we dealt with a decision just like the Cicilline case, which is a classic example of a recording that happened in a courthouse that after careful reasoning by the district court judge concluded this isn't really what we were trying to ban. This was an undercover recording in a corruption investigation, and it's not within the scope of what the rule is. If the judge had deviated from the local rule under an interpretation that says it's not covered to in a manner that is consistent with judicial conference policy, that would be a very different question for the court. Here, the decision flouts judicial conference policy. It's in direct contravention with judicial conference policy, so it's not, in our view, a close question. And I do return to the issue which counsel was careful to avoid, which is what do you do with the pilot program rule? The language that is superfluous under their interpretation is not just subsection C. It is the entire rule of 83.3.1. It cannot be that the court took the time and effort to enact the pilot program rule, carefully thought out standards about when civil proceedings can be broadcast, while having a rule that said a judge could authorize whatever broadcast it so chooses under its inherent authority in subsection A of 83.3. And I believe that's a plain language argument. It's both historical, but it's also a plain language argument because the rules have to be read in the context in which they sit in the rule book.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good argument on both sides. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.